Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As we start out 2019, we're looking back at some of the significant stories GLT brought you in 2018. Today, stories generally focusing on health, from disaster drills to preparing for a pandemic to conserving food and the sometimes tragic lack of services for those in mental health distress. It's Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. The National Resources Defense Council estimates up to 40% of all food produced in the U.S. goes to waste, even though one in eight Americans struggles to put enough food on the table. GLT's Eric Stock looks into the causes of food waste in America, what some local restaurateurs, producers, and charities are doing to reduce food waste, and how a new state law is helping some farmers find new uses for some of its produce that might otherwise end up in a landfill.
Chef Ken Mischke is in one of his three kitchens at Epiphany Farms restaurant in Bloomington as his staff prepares for the night's customers. As an environmentally conscious owner of three farm-to-table restaurants in McLean County, Mischke hates to throw out any food at all.
Most kitchens that I go in that I'm not managing, I see so much waste just from neglect of taking the 30 seconds to scrape out the pan.
Mischke symbolizes this through what he calls a million-dollar spatula. It's an exaggeration, he admits, but the point is clear. Don't waste a single drop.
If you do a good job of scraping out all the pots and pans and every time you make a recipe or every time you change a container with a spatula, then over the life of that spatula, that thing could become worth up to $1 million.
Mischke conveys his food waste mantra to his customers. Servers write the date on customers' carryout boxes so they have a reminder of how long they have to eat it. He says limiting food waste is especially challenging when working with raw produce, which typically has a one-week shelf life. But he says whether it's pork, eggs, or radishes, anything that's been sitting for more than a few days ends up in what he calls the family meal, which happens daily at each of his restaurants, Epiphany Farms at Anjou Above in Bloomington, at Old Bank in Leroy, and at his farm in Downs. Staff prepares a meal for all of his 165 employees with a food that's showing some age but still good. That keeps the food for his customers the freshest, and there's an added benefit.
It's the base of our culture. It's like, you know, a happy family sits down and has a meal together, and they have a conversation, and they get to know each other, and they enjoy a meal, and that's really what this is all about.
Food waste isn't just a problem in restaurants. It's a major issue for grocery stores. Mike Hoffman, logistics director at Midwest Food Bank at Normal, says we, the consumers, are largely to blame.
If you go to the grocery store and you have two pieces of fruit in front of you, one has a slight blemish on it and one doesn't have any blemish on it, we're all going to take the one with this perfect. We like everything really nice, right?
It's gotten to the point, Hoffman says, stores will turn away entire truckloads of apples, for example, because some look less than perfect, perhaps proving the old adage that one bad apple really can spoil a whole barrel.
It boils down to you and me, the average consumer, who's saying, look, there's nothing wrong with that fruit, but we all want the best. And that's kind of the way we are in America. We've been groomed that way.
That's where agencies like Midwest Food Bank step in. Food haulers turned away from the stores will deliver their still perfectly good produce to the food bank and its new 100,000-square-foot warehouse, where it gets repackaged into family-sized containers that can feed families for weeks. Several dozen food banks in McLean County come in weekly to pick up truckloads of food to deliver to families in need. It's an effort that relies heavily on volunteers.
What's the group repackaging thing? I think they're repackaging cereal today.
Midwest volunteers put in 220,000 hours of free labor at each of its eight locations in the U.S. and Kenya, all so the good food doesn't go to waste while many go hungry.
There's a lot of waste out there, and we're recovering as much as we can. I'm just thankful for every piece of food that's in this warehouse that we can give out that way, because that's something that's not going into the landfills, not getting wasted. And the bigger picture is we are serving people that are in need, that need a little help.
There are other charities which help to distribute food that might otherwise be destined for the landfill. Isaac Simmons is a volunteer for Veggie Oasis. Each week, he and other volunteers arrive at the end of Bloomington's weekly farmers market, hauling a wheelbarrow, offering to take the merchant's leftover produce to give to families in need. Simmons says he saw firsthand how many families were struggling with access to healthy food when he worked at the market last year.
That kind of woke me up to the food insecurity of Bloomington Normal. And it got me talking with the farmers, and then I got in contact with Veggie Oasis.
Simmons, who is a student at Illinois Wesleyan, majoring in business and religion, says he often leaves with up to 3 wheelbarrows full of prepared food, fruits, and vegetables.
I feel amazing about it, but I try not to put like how I feel about it into it, because it's really just something that that should happen normally. And so this is just something that should happen that I'm doing.
That food is then delivered to the West Bloomington Revitalization Project offices, where it's placed on tables outside for anyone to take, no questions asked. It's typically gone within an hour. Tony Maluski of Bloomington says the Veggie Oasis has given her family the chance to have a healthier diet.
It's a great help to us. It's really cut our food budget and allows us to spend money on other things that we need. It allows us to try new foods without being out much money.
The mother of 3 is often amused by what her 3 preteens want to take home and try, like okra, eggplant, and a Mexican turnip called jicama.
They pick whatever they want, and they've picked some pretty adventurous stuff, and then we take it home and we have to figure out how to prepare it and how to cook it. And we've found a lot of new things that we've tried to make part of our weekly diet, like kale chips was a popular one.
And therein lies the challenge for some families, knowing what to do with the foods with which they have little familiarity. That alone can be a turnoff. Armando Baez works for the West Bloomington Revitalization Project and has created what you would call an urban farm at his home, just a few blocks east of downtown, where he grows everything from cucumbers and tomatoes to snap peas and amaranth, a leaf vegetable similar to kale. The challenge, he says, is educating families on how to prepare certain foods they may have never seen before, and to make it in such a way their children will actually eat.
That's absolutely valid. There still has to be some sort of ongoing conversation about like how to use this food, or like what's a good way to, you know, turn this vegetable into something that's tasty.
To that end, Veggie Oasis provides menu cards to aid the uninitiated and to help ensure the produce doesn't go to waste. So how big a problem is food waste in the U.S.? Aaron Kennedy, manager of the Center for Healthy Lifestyles at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington, notes that Americans spend $218 billion planting, growing, and hauling food that never gets eaten, even though 48 million in the U.S. are food insecure.
And that's not just other states. That's right in our community, right in Bloomington, right in Chenoa, the two cities that struggle the most in McLean County with food insecurity. It's happening.
That comes from a recent study done by the McLean County Wellness Coalition, a group of business, health, and social service agencies which addresses food insecurity, obesity, and other health concerns. Kennedy says we're often a victim of our disposable culture. She says education might help prevent us from being so wasteful.
Whether it's an education or, if you use the sniff test, and that's the educational way of saying it, but think about the sell by, use by, best by labels on foods and really understand what those mean.
A local food safety expert agrees. Linda Fouch is a food program supervisor with the McLean County Health Department.
Sell by dates, use by dates, expiration dates are not all the same thing. There's aren't many true expiration dates based on FDA food code.
Fouch's mission is food safety, and even she says we're too quick to dispose of food that's perfectly fine.
And I understand that, especially when you see that people die from food poisoning, foodborne illness, hospitalizations, death.
Pouch acknowledges some circles of people ignore serious food safety risks, such as drinking unpasteurized milk, which is blamed for recent E. coli outbreak at a Tennessee daycare. She adds there are no regulations against grocery stores or restaurants donating unused food to charities. One exception, she says, is state law prevents home canned goods from being served at a permitted facility because of the risk for botulism, a rare but serious illness caused by a toxin that attacks the body's nerves and can be fatal. Fouch says when it comes to taking donated food, it's receiver beware. She recently told a local pantry it should throw out a package of raw meat that was donated in a trash bag.
Garbage bags are for garbage. They're not food grade. They're made from a recycled plastic that can leach those chemicals that were in that plastic into the food.
And food waste is often a struggle for farmers. Katie Bishop and her husband Hans both left State Farm in recent years to work on the family farm known as Prairie Earth in Atlanta. She says her favorite crop is heirloom tomatoes, and the majority of them go to waste.
Up to 60% just end up in the compost or in my kitchen to use because I can't sell them because they're so fragile. They'll crack or split, and if we don't sell them, we don't have a cannery that we can just take them to process them that way.
Changes to the state's Illinois Cottage Food Act in January give producers a chance to repurpose their crops, such as canning or freezing them or converting them into a jelly or sauce that they can sell to the public at their farm or at a market, which the Bishops and the Prairie Earth staff do each week, hoping to reach an expanded and hopefully younger customer base.
I know, you're so strong.
Bishop says that has helped them salvage perfectly good produce that might otherwise go to waste. It helped them expand their business.
A second life. I might pull a little bit of the basil from the field that was meant for a wholesale customer to use in the pesto. But for the most part, a lot of this stuff is the less than perfects, the things that people don't want to buy, but are still delicious and wonderful.
Bishop says her most environmentally conscious customers will seek out the less than perfect produce because she says they know they taste best.
Our greens might have little holes in it from the bugs that have chewed on it, or the broccoli might have a little worm in it, or yeah, there's definitely a perception of a lack of quality, but I think it's actually the opposite.
Prairie Earth is in the process of creating a food hub, a giant freezer being built on its farm that'll enable it to store and distribute produce from other regional farmers who don't have the means for larger distribution on their own. And Bobby and Brandy Hansen of Normal credit the Cottage Food Act with growing their hobby into a business. They married her love of gardening with his love of hot peppers into something that took off beyond their wildest dreams.
We first started out, I thought maybe it was just a fluke, like our friends and our family are like, yeah, it's good, you know. But when people kept coming back and saying like, hey, you gonna have some sauce for us again this year? And then we're like, okay, maybe we've got something here.
The couple grows hot peppers at their farm in Leroy, but Bobby says the hottest of the hot, including the ghost peppers and fatales, are grown in their backyard, so we can keep a close eye on them. After initially exploring whether it was worth renting space at a commercial kitchen to create a hot sauce business and realizing it was too expensive, they saw the state law had changed that allowed them to sell the sauce at the Bloomington Farmers Market, where they had also been selling the peppers, but would have to throw away what they didn't sell.
At the end, we had a whole glut of, I would say a glut of other things, and we're like, all right, we can have the rest of these peppers. What do we do with them? Well, rather than compost them, we made them into a final sauce called Season Finale.
And Bobby Hansen says that means no good pepper goes to waste.
More or less, as long as the pepper doesn't die on the vine, so to speak, we can use almost every single one of them now.
Brandy Hansen says the cottage food revisions have not only helped she and her husband grow a business that she hopes will soon pay for itself, it also helps them be better stewards of their own land.
That makes me happy because it makes me sad when I have to throw a bunch of peppers away. It's like, you know, I mean, they're your children. You've raised them from seed, and now all of a sudden, oh, you're just wasting it. I mean, it just... When somebody can use that, why do that?
And Brandy admits she's more than just a hot sauce maker. She's also become a fan.
I like them hot now. I don't do like he does where I douse everything with it. But, you know, I'll eat something. I'm like, you know, this doesn't really please me. And then I'm like, I need some hot sauce.
While these efforts are encouraging to the environmentally conscious, there's still a long way to go. The U.S. throws out close to 91 billion kilograms of food per year, more than the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Italy, and Sweden combined. That's according to the 2017 Food Sustainability Index, compiled by the British kitchen retailer Magnet. But the U.S. is not the worst when it comes to wasting food. While the average American tosses close to 300 kilos of food in the trash every year, Australians dispose of more than 360 kilos of trash on average. And Sweden isn't much better than the U.S. The most conscientious about food waste were Greece, China, India, and Russia. I'm Eric Stock.
Still to come on 89.1 and WGLT.org, a look back at changes in health from a change in local social policy. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Hear the top NPR and local GLT news stories handpicked just for you right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're looking back at health-related stories from 2018 as the new year brings us new challenges and new goals. In a time concerns arising about the social and emotional health of youth, there are not enough child psychiatrists to provide services in central Illinois. GLT's Mary Cullen reports on one typical case that shows the bottleneck in youth mental health resources in McLean County. Cullen talks with a mother who recently lost her daughter to suicide.
A little over a year ago, 16-year-old Isabel Molina was a sophomore in high school. Still learning about herself as a young woman, Isabel sent explicit photos to a boy in her class, who then shared them with their other classmates. Isabel decided the only way to cope was to take an excess of Tylenol. She took the pills, went to school, and started telling her friends goodbye. When a friend noticed something was wrong, she told the school counselor. Isabel told the counselor what she did, and an ambulance rushed her to the hospital. After the Tylenol was out of her system, the hospital transferred Isabel to a mental health facility, where they prescribed her psychotropic medicine. Isabel then moved in with her mother, Stephanie Roberts, in Bloomington Normal.
She was vocal about her feelings up until the end. So she would come to me and tell me, "Mom, I'm in a bad place. I feel like I'm going to hurt myself." So she went back into the hospital in February of this year.
Isabel was weaned off her initial medication and placed on another, only for the same to happen over and over again. A few weeks or months would pass with Isabel doing okay, and then another two-week stay in the hospital. On her fourth hospital stay, doctors took Isabel off her antidepressants and put her on two different mood stabilizers.
When we picked her up, like, you could tell, like, it's not working for her, and we knew it wasn't working for her. She was either crying hysterically, like over the littlest things would make her just completely break down, or she was very angry. There was not an in-between spot.
Roberts tried getting in contact with her daughter's psychiatrist in Bloomington Normal to fix what was wrong with Isabel's medication, but found out the psychiatrist was no longer practicing and there would be no replacement. They referred back to Isabel's pediatrician, who referred the teen to a psychiatrist in Peoria. Roberts and Isabel would have to wait to hear from the doctor for an appointment. McLean County Center for Human Services Executive Director Tom Barr says struggles to find a child psychiatrist is common throughout all of McLean County.
That's a real challenge in McLean County, particularly for youth, because there aren't any child psychiatrists in McLean County practicing at this point in time.
CHS has one psychiatrist and two advanced practice nurses on staff who can prescribe medication to youth age 12 and older, but that's only a small slice of their full caseload, which is mainly focused on adult care. Tom Barr of the Center for Human Services says CHS prioritizes services to individuals with the greatest need and the fewest resources in the county. To qualify as a client, they have to be on Medicaid. A lot of times, they refer those in need to alternate providers.
Oftentimes, it's out of the community, and that's one of the great challenges at this point in time, is the proximity to where the youth live and trying to provide services that particularly when looking at the population that we serve, who may not have the financial resources to travel a great distance. Oftentimes, the youth may end up being unserved or being seen by a pediatrician or another primary care physician.
Barr says one out of 20 people will have a severe and persistent mental illness that requires ongoing counseling and psychiatric care. That number stays consistent, he says, regardless of age group. He says local statistics don't exist because oftentimes when someone sees the lack of resources in the county, they stop looking for help. Similar to CHS, the Center for Youth and Family Solutions has two specialty programs providing mental health services to the community. One program, the Family Support Program, is application-based and restricted to youths who utilize services already in the community without success. Currently, there are only 15 youths in that program. Those clients also had to first go through the center's other program, the Screening Assessment and Support Services, or SAS. SAS assists kids with mental illness for 3 to 6 months with therapy, counseling, and possible medication prescription. Stephanie Barish is the center's regional clinical supervisor. She says SAS screens around 630 youths annually in McLean County, and roughly 430 of those kids go to counseling at the center. So how does it work for scheduling those appointments?
That sometimes is the tricky piece. Wait lists tend to go up during the school year because the need tends to increase during the school year.
Barish says that wait list is now about 3 to 4 weeks. But if a client has a greater need or serves potential risk, they can work them in faster if necessary. But to qualify for SAS, the client, again, has to be on Medicaid. So what happens when the center can't help a youth in need of mental health services? Well, they're referred to CHS to go through that similar dance. The same thing happened to Stephanie Roberts and Isabel. After waiting 2 weeks for that call back on the referral to a Peoria psychiatrist, Isabel wasn't doing well. She called her mom to pick her up early from school that day.
And she sat and she was fine at home, and she did like 2 hours of homework. And during that time, I called the pediatrician's office again, and I was like, these meds aren't working. You know, she's unable to function. And they said, you know, we gave the referral.
Roberts called the hospital and doctor's office they referred Isabel to, but the doctor had not yet looked at the referral, another long wait list. It was nearly a month since the hospital placed Isabel on mood stabilizers and released her. Roberts started Googling psychiatrists in Bloomington Normal. She says every office she called said they had no openings and told her she could not take Isabel off her meds without consultation. Isabel had private insurance, so she didn't qualify for services at the Center for Human Services and the Center for Youth and Family Solutions. There are youth psychiatrists who see clients with private insurance, but that's not their primary clientele. And those who do see youth patients have long wait lists. That's a problem for those experiencing crisis. Other organizations have to make up for the deficit. OSF's Resource Link is one of those programs. It works as a consulting link between psychiatrists and pediatricians to advise a diagnosis and prescribe mental health medication for youths in need. Kelly Barnes works as Resource Link's care coordinator for the eastern region of Illinois, including McLean County. One of Resource Link's services is facilitating a phone conversation with a certified psychiatrist. Their job is helping the pediatrician care for a client with mental illness.
Because with pediatric meds, you know, there's a lot of black box warnings. You know, there are doctors out there that are not comfortable prescribing psychotropic medication to children, which is completely fine, and we understand that. It's out of their realm of expertise.
Barnes says when a doctor feels uncomfortable taking the responsibility of prescribing those meds, Resource Link again refers the youth out of the county, and they go on another wait list. That's exactly what Stephanie Roberts says happened to Isabel when she was referred to Peoria.
One day, I don't know, I guess it just got too much, and she just decided that it was her time. So that's it. But I feel like, why is there not more psychiatrists in this town? I mean, apparently there's a need because all of them here are full. And, you know, why was she not red flagged, a 16-year-old in and out for depression, and then just told to kind of just wait?
3 months after Isabel killed herself, Roberts is still waiting to hear from the Peoria psychiatrist to see if Isabel would ever get an appointment. the problem isn't only wait lists. These wait lists wouldn't be so long if there were more youth psychiatrists in the area. Barish, with the Center for Youth and Family Solutions, says the county is experiencing a deficit.
There is absolutely a lack of pediatric psychiatrists in McLean County. Our SAS program contractually obligates me to have a psychiatric resource available for the youth in our SAS program.
The center utilizes one telepsychiatrist for their entire client list. That means clients talk with a doctor based in New Jersey through a video chat. But the center only has 4 hours of that psychiatrist's time a week. One initial meeting with a psychiatrist lasts an hour, to give some perspective. Barish says she has had to contract a psychiatrist from out of the county for the last 15 years.
This is the only resource I have been able to find. And I run a crisis program for youth who are in psychiatric crisis. So we have no one to refer these kids to when we're done. We're referring back to pediatricians or referring back to family care. We're referring, you know, to areas outside of McLean County where families are having to travel to Springfield, having to travel to Champaign if they're lucky, to find a psychiatrist if their pediatrician isn't comfortable.
Again, the center serves youth in the SAS program for a maximum of 6 months, which gets them only a handful of telepsychiatrist appointments before they need to be transferred somewhere else, back onto the wait list. Stories like Isabel's are all over. Bloomington resident Kevin McEwen tells GLT another young girl in Bloomington Normal is facing the same battle with finding local treatment. After frequent bouts of depression, she also experienced losing her psychiatrist earlier this year. McEwen says this left the 14-year-old with no one to refill her medication.
With nobody to go talk to, she also can't get medication because you're supposed to be talking with somebody to get that provided medication.
With limited means of transportation under the care of a single mother, transferring to a psychiatrist out of the county wasn't an option. McEwen says the family is still waiting to hear about a local resource.
Now, there's multiple people who say, well, I see these offices all the time. There are, but they don't see children. So children being under 18. Even. So that's kind of where a lot of people misconception around here is that there are doctors and stuff, but they don't see children.
He says these children are lacking consistency in a time that they need it most. Without a local resource for mentally ill youths in the county, the only option they have is to fend for themselves. Isabel's mom knows that firsthand.
My goal is I don't want anybody else to feel this way.
She says every path they turned for help led to more and more waiting, when time was the one thing Isabel didn't have. Tom Barr of the Center for Human Services says a lack of state funding and the fact that becoming a child psychiatrist is hard and unpopular for young professionals means the situation that trapped Isabel is not likely to change anytime soon. I'm Mary Cullen.
This is Sound Ideas. You're listening to some of the health stories of significance from 2018 on 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker, coming up in this episode focusing on significant health stories of 2018. A focus on opioids. Just now, though, last year marked a decade of indoor smoking ban in the Twin Cities. GLT's Eric Stock looks back at the arguments made for and against the smoking ban to see if new data and the passage of time have changed anyone's perspective on what was a hotly debated issue.
Bloomington Normal actually went smoke-free a year before the rest of the state. McLean County also passed its own smoking ban, but it exempted home-based businesses and 6 liquor establishments in unincorporated areas of the county. Those exemptions were later wiped out by the statewide ban. Talk of a ban sparked heated debate before its inception, particularly in bars and restaurants. Many establishment owners feared it would put a dent in their business at a time when profit margins are already thin.
You know, I saw a 15 to 20% decrease in business, and it's never gotten any better.
Tyler Holloway owns Fat Jack's Bar in downtown Bloomington and Maggie Miley's restaurant in Uptown Normal. He says it was especially tough on the bar because he sold cigars at Fat Jack's. That was about a $50,000 a year hit in sales.
I've tried to replace my cigar sales because we did quite a large amount of cigar sales, for that product out of here up until then, and then it went to zero, basically.
Holloway says many who liked to light up at his bar simply stopped coming.
There was a certain percentage of people that stopped coming out as much, put it that way. And, I know one couple that actually built a bar in their basement and just invited their smoking friends over to their house every Friday happy hour instead of coming here.
In other cases, Holloway says customers who are smoking outside are less likely buying alcohol. That also eats into sales. Fat Jack started serving food after the smoking ban was enacted, and many other bars recouped some of their lost revenue after the state legalized video gaming. Though Holloway says adding video gambling machines hasn't completely erased that shortfall. Jen Lancaster owns The Bistro, a downtown Bloomington bar, and had co-owned Lancaster's, a fine dining restaurant, which closed in 2014.
We were told in endless meetings with different parties that the non-smoking community that was always complaining about, how it was so smoky in the bars, that they would come out and now support our businesses once the ban was in effect, and that did not happen.
Lancaster's biggest objection, she says bar and restaurant owners had no say in the matter. She says several had proposed a licensing fee they'd be willing to pay to have a smoking section in their establishments. That idea, she said, fell on deaf ears.
We're small, independent bar owners, business owners, and I really thought that it should have been a decision that each of us made on our own.
While many business owners saw the indoor smoking ban as a government intrusion, health advocates praised the ban then and praised the ban now.
Our children are growing up expecting smoke-free indoor areas.
Kathy Dre, Vice President of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of Illinois, was one of the main advocates for the statewide ban when it passed in 2007. She says the health of smokers and non-smokers alike should trump the wishes of any business owner.
Restaurants and bars close all the time for many reasons. The people of Illinois have adjusted. They've come to expect indoor facilities to be smoke-free.
The American Lung Association polled Illinois residents before the smoking ban went into effect and on the 10-year anniversary of the ban. A decade ago, Illinoisans were evenly split on the issue. A decade later, nearly 9 in 10 polled said they support the ban.
I think that it says it all right there. You can't even get 9 out of 10 people to agree that the sky is blue, let alone support for a law like this.
The survey shows only 3 in 10 who smoke themselves oppose the ban. The Illinois Department of Public Health reports in the 10 years since the smoking ban passed, hospitalizations for asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and heart attacks, all conditions aggravated by secondhand smoke, have fallen 20%. In McLean County, smoking rates have dropped. Just prior to the ban, close to 21% of adults had smoked. The latest figures from 2013 showed it dropped to below 12%, nearly cut in half in 5 years. While there's no proof these bans or other restrictions have caused more people to kick the habit, Dre suggests it all plays a part.
All these things work hand in hand. The increase in the tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products also works to decrease those smoking prevalence rates.
Bar owners Tyler Holloway and Jan Lancaster, both non-smokers themselves, say the issue goes beyond health. Lancaster says the indoor ban forces smokers outside onto sidewalks that are already crowded on weekends when college students are in town. She says a combination of overly congested walkways with pedestrians, many of whom have been drinking, has often become a recipe for trouble.
You would have 2 people go out and smoke, and then all of a sudden all their friends had to go out and stand with them too. And that created some problems on the street with late night problems as far as vandalism, people making comments, etc.
And the bar owners say they don't have the time or the staffing to monitor foot traffic outside their businesses. This begs the question, who is enforcing the smoking ban? Police are typically on the front lines in the war on smoking, but Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County Sheriff's Police say they get few, if any, complaints. Sheriff John Sandage.
I think when the law was initially passed, we kind of took the stance that we weren't going to become the smoking police. However, if we do run across a violation, we will report it.
Sandage adds his officers aren't able to set aside time to specifically look for smoking scoff laws, but they do occasionally conduct sting operations looking for underage drinkers.
What we look for, of course, when we do not only bar checks, but our liquor inspections that we do through the Illinois Liquor Commission, we look for violations and have not found any.
Police believe the various public education campaigns about where you can and can't smoke have taken hold. Smoking ban enforcement responsibility actually lies with the McLean County Health Department through a federal grant provided by the Centers for Disease Control. Katie McHugh, Health Promotion Program Manager for the McLean County Health Department, says enforcement is typically based on complaints. Those can be filed on the Health Department's website. But she says the county sanitation crews will sometimes find suspected violators on their own.
We work with our environmental health, the sanitarians, to do that. So they're already going around doing routine inspections, and it's part of that checklist that they have to go through to check for ashtrays is usually the giveaway.
The county received just 8 smoking complaints in the last year. Fines start at $250, but McHugh says fines are rare.
They get a letter, and that usually takes care of it. People don't want to not be in compliance, but if need be, and I haven't had to deal with this yet, but if need be, we can go further on, and there are fines and citations that get written.
Second-time offenders are supposed to get fined $500, a third offense in the same year warrants a $2,500 fine. The county has levied 16 fines since the ban's inception in 2008, but none since 2015. Only 2 were ever fined the maximum, $2,500. McHugh says the health department puts more of its attention on prevention. It offers no smoking and no e-cigarette window signs for businesses. Though McHugh supports the ban herself, says she notices the difference whenever she leaves Illinois.
It certainly is a shock to me when I go to Indianapolis to go to concerts, or I go to Missouri and people can smoke in restaurants or things like that. I'm always thankful that in Illinois that's not something that we have to deal with. And I think most other people probably feel the same way.
The indoor smoking ban doesn't include e-cigarettes, which health advocates consider to be far more addictive and are heavily marketed to younger smokers. McHugh suspects vaping will soon be regulated the same way.
The FDA is starting to regulate them and things like that. It's just not included yet. There's all kinds of policies are starting to add language. If it already included language about tobacco, they're starting to add language about e-cigarettes too.
Bloomington banned the use of e-cigarettes in all city-owned buildings in 2016, but vaping is otherwise okay in other public buildings. While bar owners like Tyler Holloway say they don't like how the smoking ban has hurt their business, they do see some benefit.
I actually enjoy the fact that I don't have someone sitting next to me smoking at the bar, and that I don't go home at night after work smelling like an ashtray. So that is nice.
I'm Eric Stock.
Illinois is one of 25 states that has a public smoking ban. Illinois also passed laws to limit vaping and the age of purchase for that particular chemical. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This episode of Sound Ideas is composed of significant health stories GLT reported in a year just ended. Coming up, how the health system responds in an epidemic. As the national opioid epidemic continues, representatives from the medical treatment insurance fields met recently in Bloomington to talk about more collaboration to care for addicts and prevent addiction. GLT's Mary Cullen has more on a roundtable discussion of what effective treatment means and what it does not.
24 people have died from opioids in McLean County so far this year, most by accidental overdose. That's according to Chestnut Health System's CEO, Dave Sherrar. This year, Chestnut admitted 800 adults and adolescents for opioid use. Nearly 20% identified prescription opioids as their primary drug of choice. The remaining 80% named heroin as their primary drug. Sherrar says many heroin users start out using prescription medication, but migrate to heroin after the prescription runs out. Dr. John Wieland is a general surgeon with Integrated Surgical Specialists.
I was part of the problem, and I am now trying to be part of the solution in terms of this opioid crisis that we face in the country today.
A 2016 Health and Human Services statistic shows that 11.5 million people misuse or abuse prescription opioids, causing an average of 116 deaths a day nationwide.
We are obviously in a crisis. It's been called an epidemic. And I think that that's probably legitimate.
Wieland says the drug industry is to blame for aggressive marketing of synthetic opioids, but he says opioid prescribing doctors also hold some responsibility for the epidemic.
We started out with noble intentions. We wanted to cure pain instead of manage pain.
Wieland says early research showed cheaply made synthetic narcotics were less addictive, but data in the late 20th century misjudged the implications of overprescribing opioids.
At the time, they called pain the fifth vital sign. And even though many physicians disputed this, it became a metric by which some physicians were actually judged by and performance measured. And still today, we're trying to extricate ourselves from that.
Included in that, Wieland says, is changing how physicians use patient satisfaction surveys. So what are doctors doing to combat the already rampant opioid crisis? Wieland says the number one goal is obvious: prescribe fewer opioids. Illinois passed a law in 2014 requiring handwritten and signed opioid prescription orders. Wieland says this law created a barrier to access that proved helpful. It was no longer as simple as calling the doctor and asking them to put in a refill. He says the law also led to more prescription monitoring programs, which drew attention to polypharmacy problems, or patients who utilized multiple opioid prescribers without providers knowing. Now, Wieland says doctors are better at acknowledging that pain is subjective. People rate it differently, he says, which means prescribing pain medication is not one size fits all.
Pain is not a vital sign. It cannot be objectively measured. And so therefore, each patient has to be treated on their own level.
He says doctors are going back to prescribing pre-narcotic medicines for pain, like acetaminophen and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Or in some cases, Wieland says, not using drug treatment at all and prescribing massages, acupuncture, biofeedback, or even yoga. Illinois Department of Insurance's Regional Outreach Coordinator Carol West says a major change in opioid treatment coverage promotes those alternative treatment methods. In 2020, Illinois will be the only state in the nation to change its benchmark plan. West says a benchmark plan is what all other insurance plans are based off of in the state, including the base benefits package. West says the change will mandate coverage for alternative pain therapies like those mentioned by Dr. Wieland. She says those who have not taken opioids before will benefit greatly.
The limit on opioid prescriptions for acute pain mostly talks to the opiate naive.
So those experiencing pain somewhere between 3 to 6 months. She says this change requires the insurance agency to give anyone prescribed 50 milligrams or higher of an opioid at least one reversal agent nasal spray to prevent overdoses. Since starting medical practice in the early 1990s, Dr. Wieland says he has cut his opioid prescriptions by about 75%.
Which is not a boast. It's almost a little embarrassing to admit that, to realize it, because that means that I was over-prescribing that amount for patients.
He says the average number of pain pills that one of his post-operative patients use is 10, but his routine prescription used to be about 30 pills. Now, Wieland says it's doctors' collective role to educate patients on the risks of dependency when prescribing opioids.
You know, most patients that have routine surgery don't have a goal of becoming an opioid addict.
He says doctors need to be aware of that and treat addictive behavior as the symptom it is, and not just shun those who are opioid dependent. Even with doctors like Whelan prescribing fewer opioids, some still become addicted and seek help at treatment centers like Chestnut Health Systems. Brian Hinman is the court treatment coordinator at Chestnut. He says there are negative perceptions of addiction treatment that are simply not true. Hinman says caregivers treat people with compassion rather than viewing treatment facilities like a prison. Clients are not in lockdown and have varying degrees of freedom. He says a residential crisis detox, for example, lasts 5 to 7 days. That allows clients to get opioids out of their system and introduce them to mental health support services.
Treatment's collaborative. It starts with the client, what their needs are, what they think is important, and create some structure there. And it's not so much authoritative as more of, again, collaborative.
Hinman says creating structure in the former addict's life is not always easy, but it can set patients up for a productive life outside of the facility. I'm Mary Cullen.
Chestnut Healthcare started in the early 1970s as an alternative to jail for individuals with public intoxication. It has since expanded to multiple service lines with an estimated 700 employees throughout the world. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, how ISU plans and trains to keep people safe in emergencies. Imagine this scene. An anthrax scare descends upon a Chicago festival with more than 100,000 people in attendance. There are festival goers from all over the state, and they bring the threat of this potentially deadly bacterial disease with them. So the governor orders emergency medications to be dispensed to all 102 counties within 24 hours. Could McLean County handle a mass distribution to its more than 170,000 residents in such a short period of time? As another of our health-focused stories of 2018 unfolds, Eric Stock reports health and emergency officials tried to simulate that scenario in a full-scale exercise in Normal.
Redbird Arena, one of the few places in the county large enough for a mass distribution of medications, was the test site as staff from the McLean County Health Department, Illinois State University, McLean County Emergency Management, the Normal Fire Department, and more than 100 volunteers simulated how they could dispense medications to thousands of people and, when necessary, check them for potential anthrax exposure. One of the volunteers was Jenny Riggins of Normal. It's an exercise of particular interest to her. As a retiree of ISU's Student Health Services, Riggins says she was impressed with how well the event was organized, but noticed some potential problem spots. In one instance, she played a mom with two young children.
They didn't offer me any particular accommodation, so I had to fill out information on a clipboard, and I probably have this four-month-old on the front of me in a pack, and I maybe have the two-year-old in a stroller. I'm thinking that would have been quite challenging.
Riggins adds parents might have been expecting liquid medications for their young children. That, she says, would have created another obstacle.
There were instructions, very detailed instructions, that you have to smash up the pills, combine them with water, figure out how much dose to give. That would be a challenge to the modern parent because they would have never done that.
McCartney Britton from Colchester decided to take part in the exercise as he is studying emergency management at Western Illinois University. We joined Britton for a walkthrough as he tried to get life-saving meds for himself and his neighbor.
Right now we're filling out, it's basically who you are, and what members are, like, if you're picking up for your family, like right now the actor that I'm playing, I'm picking up for my homebound neighbor. So I got to put his name and his information on this sheet, too, and see if they'll dispense for me or not. And then basically it's also, do I have any allergies to any of the medication that they're going to be dispensing for the anthrax exposure?
What followed for Britton was a maze of confusion and sometimes conflicting messages. It required patience and persistence.
I'll be able to pick up for my neighbor today. I don't actually have his information, but he's homebound, so he's actually not able to make it to the pod.
I believe we need to know at least if he's allergic, so we know what kind of medicine to give him. Do you have that information?
Nope, I just have her name, age, and weight. She's 90 years old, so she can't get out very well.
Well, we can we can mark a question mark, and you can ask the nurses. We'll go ahead and fill out her information as much as you know.
Is it relatively painless?
That one was actually a little bit more difficult when you're picking up for somebody that's not your immediate family and you don't have all the information that they're going to need, whether or not, you know, if she's allergic to the medication or not.
You didn't get a definitive answer.
I did not, so hopefully we'll talk to the nurses and see what they say.
When you're all complete here, I would like for you to go down. There's a medical examinations table. Go down and talk to them about your symptoms, but also explain to them Sherry's needs
okay.
as well.
Okay.
So were you able to get the medications for your neighbor?
No, not at this time. I have to go speak with the medical evaluation team, talk about my symptoms, and then explain Sherry's needs and why she can't be here. And hopefully we get a good answer.
So you still have to sell it?
Yep, still have to sell it.
Hi.
Hello. I'm sent over here to talk to you about my symptoms. I've got swollen lymph nodes. I've been sore throat, coughing, feeling tired for the last 2 days. And I'm also need to talk to you guys about picking up for my neighbor, Sherry Wright. She's homebound. She's 90. And so she can't make it here to get the medication.
Okay. Can I take a look at what you got so far?
Yep.
You don't have a form filled out for Sherry.
They didn't give me one. The last lady at the nurse's station, she took the address form and all that with her on there.
I think you need to go back to the line at the beginning because I need to have a form on Sherry.
Sherry was on my last form. Like I said, the nurse just took it when she gave me my Cipro and then said I needed to come talk to you guys about Sherry's meds.
Okay. Is Sherry allergic to doxycycline?
I'm not sure of her allergies.
Okay. Does she have any medical conditions that you're aware of?
She's just homebound due to her age.
Okay.
She's 90.
All right. So Sherry's going to get doxycycline. It's going to be one tablet of a mouth every 12 hours as directed.
So you got him.
I did. And like another thing that, you know, thank God this is a training exercise because, you know, it's just another thing that, there's going to be people out there for their neighbors or, you know, elderly in nursing homes even that won't be able to come in here to the pod. And it's going to be definitely a learning experience to figure out what the correct way to do it. So I'm just glad that I was able to help Sherry today.
Those seeking medications but needed special attention, such as those with a language barrier, or hearing impaired or wheelchair bound, were diverted to a special functions room. Ceci Gaspardo served as supervisor there.
What's the biggest challenge to running an exercise like this, especially if it were to be the real thing?
The language barrier, because we do have Spanish-speaking employee or staff, but if it were a real life and we would need a Chinese, Mandarin, Russian, Polish, any other languages, we would have to get on a phone and do a three-way call. That would take a lot longer.
How quickly would you be able to do that?
We do have a contract with an interpreter server or agency that provides interpretive of any language that we need, and we could probably get them on the phone within a minute.
What have you learned about this experience so far that's adaptable to the real thing?
That it does not always run smoothly as planned. There's always some things that can be improved.
Any examples of things that you could not have prepared for?
Actually, yes. Forms, and we're making a list of what we need. Forms not in place, pens not in place, just things that we thought the patients were going to bring with them from the first station that they were at.
So this has already been a learning experience.
Oh, yes, yes, and we're writing things down.
And that may seem somewhat trivial, but seconds matter in a situation like this.
Yes, yes, they do.
Watching this exercise unfold were the managers who will be responsible for making sure the real thing, if it's ever necessary, is carried out smoothly and efficiently. They gathered across the street from Redbird Arena inside Illinois State University's Emergency Operations Center. Eric Hodges is ISU's Director of Emergency Management.
An event like this, none of us can do on our own. We have to have partners. We have to rely on each other. And we've been planning for this for a year, and those partnerships really showed today.
Were there any light bulb moments like, yeah, we didn't think of that?
The biggest thing that I wasn't sure about is whether this regional EOC would work or not, and it did. That was specifically a question I asked, and we want to all work together now in the same physical space to try to coordinate an incident like this, should it ever take place.
What's in there physically, practically, that you're able to use?
So we do have tables that hold about 20, 25 people in the EOC. We have computing, networking, cameras, situational awareness, social media, ability to print out digital maps and so forth. All those resources that we need to be effective at coordination are all in that space, and everybody gets to use them.
And that includes McLean County Health Department Director Camille Rodriguez. She says the exercise shows how well the partner agencies work together and showed there's room for improvement.
I think there were some very obvious and logistical things that we didn't think about. Putting water at the end of the line instead of putting it at the beginning on a pretty warm day was something that we observed of ourselves. We thought, well, of course, we'll give every participant a bottle of water, but it was out in the sun and it was at the end of the line. So that sounds like a simple thing, but really important to keep people hydrated when they are likely spending a large amount of time in line. Another thing logistically, and I served as sort of the emergency operations center manager, we had issues with needing more staff, and we didn't have more staff. And so we had to adjust and mitigate that by asking some of the volunteers to kind of serve as staff. And in a real-life emergency, is that something we could do with a healthy person? Not so sure exactly, but there I'm giving you a real-life example of how we had to adjust.
One comment I heard from one of the folks that went through the line was, while they were able to get through pretty quickly, if this were a real-life emergency, Redbird Arena would be full of people. There would be thousands possibly making their way through the doors all at once as opposed to a couple of dozen. And, of course, you would have the stress of a real-life situation. How would that potentially impact that?
So the folks that I was working with in the room, leaders of the respective agencies, had those similar discussions. It's all about how we communicate to the public in getting them to the arena in sort of a sequential manner, in trying to contact certain groups of people to come first, as much as we can trying to make it organized, as well as contacting, our bus systems and other ways to get people into the arena in an orderly manner. So while in as much as we want to plan ahead and think that it would work well, we know that in a real-life situation, that Redbird Arena would be full of people, but we would make sure, and that's why we practice, that's why we have these events to make sure that we know how we can make it the most orderly for people so they get the help that they need.
Eric Stock reported on an anthrax drill. He says the medications for such an event would come from a national stockpile of reserve medications. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has warehoused at undisclosed locations all over the country. They were last deployed during an anthrax scare in 2001. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In 2018, Illinois State University increased efforts to train faculty and students to run, hide, or fight if an active shooter came to campus. In this story that contains the sound of gunshots, GLT's Mary Cullen reports this came 8 months after the deadliest high school shooting in the U.S.
Illinois State University Police Chief Aaron Woodruff fires a starter pistol into the empty hallway of Metcalf Lab School, signifying the start of ISU's annual Run, Hide, Fight drill. Dozens of ISU faculty, students, and staff scramble to barricade classrooms or escape from the supposed shooter. ISU police and emergency management volunteers scream in the hallways. Eric Hodges is ISU's emergency management director.
We have a couple of people out in the hallway trying to create a realistic environment. So someone's firing off a starter pistol to create that sound. Others are out in the hallway screaming, begging to be let in, screaming that somebody's got a gun and so forth. Again, to get people kind of in the mindset of what's going on, and it works. If you look at the people in the room and their reactions, they take to those the senses that they're hearing.
There are two sessions. First, trainers tell people in each room what they're doing, running, hiding, or fighting. In the run room, participants hear the shot fired. They use the sound to try to determine how far away the shooter is and break out of the classroom through the nearest door. People in the hide room have electric cables to tie doors shut. They use tables and chairs as barricades. Meanwhile, the shooter breaks into the fight room too fast for subjects to barricade any door. Hodges says he expects participants to throw foam objects at the shooter to disorient her until the group can swarm and take the shooter down.
The intruder made their way in the room right away before anyone had a chance to run or barricade that
that room. And so I saw people acting immediately, within seconds. These typically ended today in about 4 to 5 seconds, is they were throwing the foam objects that we gave them to use at the intruder, and they swarmed them, and they got it done within 4 to 5 seconds.
For the late morning training, participants get no coaching and have to decide how to respond. On February 14th, 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz walked down the campus of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, with an AR-15 and killed 14 students and 3 faculty members. 45 calls of concern about Cruz and his family were sent in to local law enforcement over 10 years, according to information obtained by CNN following the shooting. But even after consistent reports of behavioral issues, Cruz somehow slipped through the cracks. Classmates called him stressed out, a teen with anger management issues, and a fascination with firearms and gun violence. Chief Woodruff says there's almost always one final straw that breaks the camel's back. The passing of Cruz's mother 3 months before the shooting in Parkland was that straw. Woodruff says his department at ISU receives almost daily reports about students with suicidal thoughts or actions. He says they can only control the environment that the student is in. That is, lessening the risk of that student spiraling out of control.
GLT's Mary Cullen reporting. ISU and emergency management hold one run, hide, fight training a year. Those interested in learning more about how to prepare for an active shooter in their workplace can reach out to police. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and this episode of some of the health and emergency related stories GLT brought you in 2018. Thanks to Eric Stock and Mary Cullen. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.